Where would you like to go?
That's, oh, wherever you like.
You were, I think, talking about the HIV cell story, as it were. And that seemed to me to raise a whole bunch of interesting questions
okay, so
that we should
the
explore.
Part of it? Okay.
Yeah.
The CCR5 will be changing. Okay. The second part of my paper, I was trying to focus more on the property rights that people might have in their physical cells, in their DNA. And then a difference maybe between researchers, people who conduct research on somebody's cells and the information that's derived from that research, and then versus the person's, what property rights they have in the actual, you know, physical cells from their body. So I mentioned there were two men who were both in a high-risk group for contracting HIV in the early 80s. And one of the men who was interviewed said that he had, you know, witnessed about 70 or 80 his friends and romantic partners die over a period of time. So he realized there was something anomalous with him. He realized there was something going on where he wasn't contracting HIV and everybody else was. There was also a second man, this is in the United States, in the 80s, who realized the same thing. Now, both of these men at different times, they sought out clinical trials. Researchers who were conducting clinical trials of medications and working on, you know, just researching the development of HIV and working on medications. And they actually were turned down, I think, by a couple different places before finding a researcher at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Institute in New York City. I think there were maybe five steps here. So first, they identified that they were anomalous individually. So with no help from physicians or anything, they made their own observations that there was something going on inside their bodies that was preventing them from contracting HIV when everyone else was getting it, and they were had the same risk as everyone else. Secondly, they approached the scientists, many different scientists, until they found one who would talk to them, and they suggested, thirdly, that they should be studied. They suggested that to the researcher. And then fourth, they actually physically participated in the research. And then fifth, they also helped to get publicity for the research that was going on. You can see that they did make some kind of significant contribution. But they actually were, later on, the research from the blood that they provided in their cells led to, two things. One, a test for people who actually have this delta 32 mutation. So if you have two copies of this gene, you actually seem to be completely resistant from the HIV types that use that specific receptor to get into your cell, which is significant. That would protect you against most of the HIV infections. Not all of them, but most of them. They developed a whole new class of medications. That was in 2008, so it wasn't actually that long ago that they came out with this whole new class of medications. And these medications have really helped people, and there was actually a guy who had leukemia as well as HIV, and they did a bone marrow transfusion from somebody who had this delta 32 mutation, and it seemed to clear the infection, but they cannot detect HIV in him anymore. However, he's a very rare case, and that wouldn't be any kind of model for treatment, but that's an example that this was turned to be a very effective, you know, research and effective treatment that was developed from, information they gained from these people's cells. So this presents, I think, some interesting questions about where the property rights should lie and should, you know, how much of a claim do they have to the, to any IP rights over whether it is, do they, it is extend as far as, you know, research, as tests, as medications that were derived from the information, or is it only, does their property right maybe seem to end with anything derived directly from their cells. So I thought those steps, that would be maybe an interesting thing to explore. Do you have any suggestions? Yes.
Do you think they signed, I'm assuming they signed something at some point when they, like, entered the program, mm-hmm. even if it was, maybe it was just a consent form or, you know, that I agree to this test, blah, 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 blah.
Yes, I don't know what they signed. I know now, if you get your blood taken, or even before you do that, a doctor's appointment at some university hospitals, they're doing research, you sign a consent form that says that they can use your blood and genetic material and discarded tissue. Now, for this, I know these people volunteered, but I'm not sure if they signed anything. But they seem to think that they were both upset that they did not receive any royalties from either the test or from the medication that was developed. So I think, yeah, that would be something important. You were suggesting, like, if somebody were to set up privately maybe a grant or something, so maybe through the patent system wouldn't be an appropriate mechanism to be rewarding these people, but maybe something like...
Let me put it as a question. Suppose somebody had a charity, and the purpose of the charity is to give $1 million to each of these two people. How many people here would make some contribution to that charity? These are the two people who spotted the fact that they weren't dying, went to the trouble of reporting it, and the result is that we may have a way of curing AIDS eventually from that. We don't know if we will, but that's the story she's telling. I suppose it's true. All right. Because it seems to me that is sort of, it's outside of the IP framework. But one natural response when you sell, hearing this story, I say, these people deserve to be rewarded, is great, let's reward them. That's a different approach from the standard one. And I think I made a somewhat related suggestion earlier when we were talking about patents for pharmaceuticals, that maybe one approach to solving the problem would be to get somebody much richer than us to buy out the patent on the second best drug of some source, public domain it, and that way people have cheaply available, not the best, but a pretty good cure. Anyway, it occurred to me that an interesting way of thinking about it, let me turn this back on again. Because I didn't want to distract from what you're doing. If it will turn on. Will it turn on? Is it turning on? Yes, it's turning on. Anyway, it seemed to me that an interesting way of thinking about the questions you're raising was a twofold division of how you use it and a threefold division of how the law might treat it. And that's what's going to be coming up in a minute, assuming this thing works. Hasn't yet. That to my intuition, at least, you have two rather different cases. One of them is the case where I get information from your cells. Another is the case where I actually have cells descended from your cells. All right? And those feel different to me. So imagine that I've got possession of your cells in a way that was in no way wrongful. For example, I'm a surgeon. I did some surgery on you. That process gave me some waste material that I cut out of you, maybe some cancer tumor. And looking at that tumor, I learned something. That sounds rather different from the case which you mentioned when we were talking, where I cut something out of you. I then find those cells have an interesting characteristic, so I create a cell line based on the cells I cut out of you, which I then sell to other people for their research, so to speak. And those I don't know what the right rules are either, and those feel to me at least like two rather different categories. And one way I was thinking about it, leaving aside the cell business, there are two different ways you can observe people using me. One of them is that I actually do work for them. And our feeling is that we don't believe in slavery and people aren't entitled to say, yes, you must do this work for me whether you like it or not. But another way is by observing me. Suppose someone is doing research on what personality types lead people to go into what profession. And so they get a list of law professors and they pick randomly some subset of that list. They then look at those people, and for a moment, suppose they're not interviewing, so I'm not involved at all directly, but they get information about my personality type from publicly available information. And they then do research, and they conclude, this type should go into law, this type should go into that, and so forth. They're using me in a real sense, all right? They're getting information from me, and yet I don't feel as though I ought to have any property right over there doing that. All right. Any more than I should have any property right over observing that two friends of mine got married, the marriage broke up. I wonder if this type of person doesn't get along well with that type of person. There are all sorts of ways in which we're learning by observing other people that we don't usually think of as somehow infringing their rights. So it seemed to me that in a way my two genetic cases were like that. That one of them is the case where I am observing something I've got a right to observe. It's true as something of yours. I learned something from it. Another is I'm actually using something of yours. And I actually have cell line descended from it. And now, so I was thinking, therefore, learn from cell versus descend from cell. And then it seemed to me that there are at least three ways you could imagine handling this in the law. One is the no right case. And what I mean by the no right case is that you got some cells of mine because when I went out of your office, I grasped the door handle, some dead skin cells got onto the door handle, and you then cultured those cells. And maybe you used them to clone me. That feels wrong to me. I'm not sure if it should feel wrong, but it feels to me as though you, without my permission, have used me as opposed to learning from me. Right. Suppose you use those cells to get some information. That's not so clear to me. Maybe that one's all right. I don't know. So, but anyway, the no right case would be the case which says, I have no rights at all with regard to my cells. Obviously, you're not entitled to kidnap me and, you know, cut off a bit of me to study. But if you can get either my cells or information about my cells without doing anything that's itself wrongful. I'm sort of thinking almost analogously of trade secret law, where normally if you're not doing anything wrongful, you're all right. So that would be the no right case. And you might, the reason I set it up that way is you might say, well, no right is the right rule for learning from cells, but not the right rule for descending from cells. Or maybe you'd say it's the right rule for both, or maybe for neither. Second possibility is the sort of ordinary property right. And the ordinary property right would say that if those AIDS people, when they came in, signed something saying, we give you permission to use our cells for anything, the cells we're doing for anything you like, then it's over. You know, property right includes the fact that it's transferable and you can give it to somebody else. But that would then say that if I got a hold of your cells without any consent by you, then you still own them. And again, you might imagine doing that rule with regard to descent from cells, but not for learning from cells. That's, in some sense, I guess that fits my intuition, not having thought about it very long. But it seems to me that if you get a hold of my cells without my consent, but without violating any of my rights, that's my dead skin cells on the doorknob example, that I'm not sure I have an objection if you learn stuff from them. If you say, well, you know, this is an interesting guy, he's got certain characteristics, let's do a full DNA analysis of his DNA and figure out, as you may know, there is a private firm which, with consent, is doing this on a very large scale. That's 23andMe. 23andMe, I think that's what it's called. People know about this? You ought to know about it. I'm a customer. This is a firm which you pay them money, and you send them a swab from your cheek, which has cells on it. They send you the kit and you do the swab. They then do not a complete genotype, it's too expensive, but a partial DNA analysis of it. And they then send you information. So they then say, you have the following variant of this gene, and the statistical evidence suggests that your risk of such and such a result is substantially above average, or substantially below average, or average. So that, for example, they informed me a couple of, must have been about 2 years ago, maybe a little less than 2 years ago, that I had an above average risk of a meningioma, which is the most common form of tumor inside the skull. I don't quite want to call it a brain tumor because the tumor in the membrane that separates the brain from the skull. And they said, you've got a higher than average risk of that. Now, this wasn't very useful information because I'd had surgery to remove the meningioma shortly before they told me this. That's why I've got a scar up here. But it was sort of neat seeing that they had, in fact, correctly spotted. It's not very strong evidence. They didn't say you're certain to get it or anything, but still it was an interesting case. But they're doing that. They also simultaneously will tell other people, the genetic evidence suggests that so-and-so might be related to you. Would you like to ask him to get into communication with you? so that every month or so I get a message from them which says, so-and-so would like to look at your genetic information or would like to communicate with you or whatever. Do I have your permission? So they're doing it in a fashion, all of which involves people's permission. Another thing they do, which is also quite interesting, is that when you go up on their website, you may, if you wish, go through, essentially answer lengthy questionnaires of many, many different sorts, but they're designed to get information about you. And what they're doing is building up statistical data, because they're saying, suppose we find that all of the people who like brandy have the following genetic variant, or all the people who find brandy tastes horrible have the following genetic. It's an imaginary case. But the real case, which was actually quite informative for me, is that one of these tests, they're showing you pictures of small parts of people's faces, and you're supposed to ask to say what emotions they're expressing from looking at that. What was interesting is that while my result on that test was well above random, it was about the fourth percentile of the distribution. I am apparently extraordinarily bad at reading emotion from faces. Well, that's a very interesting fact for me to know. It suggests maybe one reason why I offend people without realizing it is that I'm not correctly picking up on the signals. So 23andMe is really quite neat, and it costs like something between $50 and $100. I don't remember exactly what it is at the moment. To do it, you are simultaneously contributing to knowledge, because you're building up the database of information of the relation between genetic characteristics and things that matter to people, and getting information from yourself. That long digression, but I thought it was sort of worth it, because that's something that's actually out there in the real world, as you may know. As you may also know, there is a long-standing project predating the modern science on this, for dealing with a genetic disease that afflicts Ashkenazi Jews, that is my ethnic group. And it's the project consisted basically of maintaining elaborate records based, I think, on genealogy, on whether Tay-Sachs disease had shown up in your ancestry, and setting it up so that if you wanted to date a girl, you went to this private organization and they would say that's really a mistake, because this is a disease where it's recessive. So you can be a carrier of one of the two copies of the gene. You've got it. No harm to you at all. You're just fine. She's carrying one. No harm to her. She's just fine. You have a kid, one chance in four. This kid has this very serious hereditary disease. So maybe you'd better date somebody else. All right. And that was sort of another neat example of an approach to this sort of problem outside the box we're normally talking about. It was just done voluntary organizations. I don't know how long it's been going, but I would guess decades is my general impression. So anyway, so let me go to my graph, which is really coming out of my listening to your paper. So it was one of the papers that didn't say enough but raised really neat questions, which is a good start. So you can imagine then that we have no right. You can imagine I have no property right. But third, you could also imagine a non-waivable right. You could imagine a legal rule which says it doesn't matter what you signed when you donated the cells. Those cells are yours from now to eternity, and if anybody wants to do anything with them, they need not just permission once from you that gave them the cell. It's not transferable. You need to consent. You're entitled, or maybe not even consent, maybe it's just you're entitled to half whatever they made from you. You could imagine different versions of that. And the model I was thinking about, which I don't know a lot about, but some of you may know, is moral rights in European copyright law. Because my understanding of European law, I think, is if I'm a painter and I sell you a painting, I don't think it is possible for me to sell you the painting along with permission for you to destroy it, or along with permission for you to repaint it, to modify it. I think. Anybody know more than I do about moral rights? No. That is, I think the basic idea is that an artist has certain rights with regard to his artwork, which don't go with sale, which remain with him permanently. I may have told you, I told this class the story about the University of Chicago Law School student newspaper article. With University of Chicago Law School, the physical building was built by a famous architect. And at some point, I think before I was there, they modified it substantially to expand the building. And one day, when I was a faculty fellow there, I opened up the student newspaper, and there the headline story is the heirs of the architect have sued under moral rights rules to make them put the building back the way they found it. And it took me a while to realize this was the April 1st issue of the newspaper.
But it's, that was one thing that got me interested in sort of the whole idea of moral rights. That's an interesting concept. So I say, so the question I wanted to raise for her and for all of you is what goes into each of those boxes that if reusing your cell to get information is the right rule, no right, property right, or non-labelable right, if reusing your cell to actually get cells descended from those cells is the right rule, no right, property right, or non-labelable. Any opinions? Yes?
How did you obtain the cells?
That's something which will determine the implications of that rule. It doesn't determine... The whole point is that if the rule is no rights, then it doesn't matter how you obtain them. You might, obviously, if I obtain them by knocking you over the head, I'm liable for assault or whatever. But as far as the rights with regard to the cells, if the rule is no right, that's the matter thing. If the rule is a property right, then if I obtain them by a valid contract, the equivalent of a sale, as it were, I'm home free, if not, none. And if it's a non-waivable right, it doesn't matter how I obtain them, because I don't own them whether I have your consent or not. Right? So I think the way to put the question is not to start by how I obtain them, but how ought the rights to depend on how I obtain them? Because that's really the difference among my three different rules, isn't it?
If I remember right, the California Supreme Court addressed something like this.
Tell us about it. Great.
In Moore versus UC Regents.
Yes.
He had leukemia, and when he went into the UC Regents hospital, I don't remember which hospital it was, they took out some of the cells and did all this kind of stuff with him, and the doctor, when he took out the cells, knew that he could probably use this to develop some sort of pharmaceutical.
There was something special about
the situation where they could use that.
Yep.
So the doctor took it out, took his spleen out, and used the spleen. It was some sort of like hairy cell leukemia or something like that. Used the spleen to develop some sort of pharmaceutical, and then continually called him and made him come back for follow-ups. And in the follow-ups, they took out more blood samples, they did this, they did that. They kept on calling them under the guise of, you know, we need to do more testing, we need to do more testing. And he kept on consenting to the more testing, so they took out his blood, they took out cell samples and everything like that. And they basically said, California Supreme Court basically said that this was like discarded materials, and because of how they obtained it and it wasn't wrongful, that he had no property right. So they more talked about the property right, at least in that case, the California Supreme Court did. At least in that case, they talked about the property right turning on how...
But that means that they were claiming it was my middle category, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that's why I was...
But that's why that's described in the middle category. Now, the particular story, you might argue that it was obtained fraudulently.
Yeah.
Then as you describe the story, he might have a...
That was his argument, but the California Supreme Court said that it didn't. And they were saying how the doctor acted was okay because the tests were, they were still using the test for certain other things, and then the extra blood they were using for other tests.
And I would have thought that if what was going on was that there were legitimate medical reasons for doing further tests.
There was legitimate reasons, but they were also using it all for other areas.
Right, but then if the rule is a straightforward property right, in most contexts, it's not illegal to buy something from somebody without telling them how valuable it is.
Right.
All right, that's... Not only is it not illegal, Thomas Aquinas says that it's not even... I guess not even sinful. Though clearly it's more generous the other way. There's this neat bit in Aquinas somewhere where he is imagining a case where there's a famine and you have a wagon full of food, of grain, I suppose, and you're the first wagon to get to the famine area. And you happen to know that there are five more wagons on the road behind you. And the question is, are you obliged to tell the buyers, when they offer to buy your grain at a high price, by the way, there are five more wagons behind me? And Aquinas says, no, it says you'd be a better person if you would. It would be a generous thing to do, but it is not unjust for you to sell it at what it says. I don't know if he's right or not, but those are an interesting case, and people have been thinking about that kind of issue at least that long, and probably much longer than that. So what people do is, let's take for a moment, in this case, were they learning from his cell, or are they actually creating cells descended from his cell?
I couldn't tell you. I remember the studies that he did
that they did with his cells resulted in a patent or pharmaceutical.
But again, if I think about copyright law, there is, because I guess that's part of where some of my innovations are coming from. If I read your book and I say, you know, a book where heroes who are apparently unimportant and weak people save the world by going on a terribly dangerous quest, make a really good story, I'm going to write a book like that. I haven't violated Tolkien's copyright. Even though I've learned something important from him. And I would guess, I mean, my suspicion is that on net, the fantasy authors of the last, 50 years are all in debt to Tolkien. Not all of them, that's not fair. But a sizable fraction of them wrote better books because they had read Lord of the Rings. Right? That was really a breakthrough work of art. Nonetheless, I don't think that, you know, they should say thank you to him if he's still alive, which he isn't, but I don't think they owe him anything. On the other hand, if you took a chunk of his work and put it better than your work, you do. And that's sort of the intuition that makes me feel as though there's a difference between your story in the case where they studied his cells, deduced from studying his cell that the reason that this kind of leukemia happens is that you have cells that don't make the following protein, and that therefore if we feed people that protein, maybe that will cure that kind of... That seems to me is a different case than the case where they take his cell, make a cell line that descends from his cells, and then do a test for this kind of leukemia, which depends on which uses those cells. The other people agree with my intuition or not, because it's not like I've got a good argument.
Yep.
I do in general. Do you think there's a difference? What if the thing you learn from the cell isn't until 50 years later? What if you collect this sample? We were assuming there's some property right in the sample, but you hold on to it. You don't learn anything immediately. You put it in a freezer, and it's not until substantially later that anyone, you know, breaks the thing back out. Says, "Oh my goodness, this is the key to our problem." It seems to me that people might be bothered. I don't know if there's some legal basis for this, but might be bothered by the idea of that researcher just has my genetic material and he's keeping it, you know, forever, potentially. Whereas they'd be less troubled by someone who sort of immediately uses that material and doesn't keep it. But that doesn't really change.
What about my distinction between learning and descending? Is there anybody who thinks that if you've gotten some of my skin cells without either my permission or violating my ordinary rights, as in the cases I described, and studying those cells tells you something interesting, should I have any right over your use of that knowledge? Anybody think I should? Next time, the other extreme, you've gotten my skin cells, and due to some slight minor improvements in our current technology, you can clone me. You produce an infant, and you're a good, responsible person. You want something to be properly raised. So you go around and you find some people who would really like to adopt an infant. And oddly enough, they really like to adopt an infant just like me. And so they're willing to pay $50,000 for permission. Now, it turns out under our current law, you can't pay permission to adoption. But that's an unfortunate feature of our current law. Posner's objection to that is one reason he'll probably never be on the Supreme Court. But suppose, imagine for a moment a legal regime where you can sell the adoption rights. And we're going to assume that they are not mistreating the child in any way, that it's a situation, we'll assume a situation where if they have gotten the child through a mother giving up a child for adoption, it would have been perfectly legitimate for them to say, here's the reason, because this is a really great baby, pay me $50,000 for it, but this one they got by getting some of my skin cells and cloning me. Do people feel as though that's a case in which my grounds for objection are much stronger than in the research case? Yes? No? Yes?
Joseph? This question about the concerns, privacy concerns, or as opposed to merely just being information. So it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to separate those things.
Suppose for a moment, combining that with your story, that for some reason they don't clone me until after I'm dead. So therefore, but I've got heirs. All right? So therefore, there's no issue of I will feel uncomfortable about this child's existence, so to speak. That in fact, I have never donated to a sperm bank. And the reason I've never been asked to, I'm not sure that's the reason, whatever, but the reason I would be very reluctant to donate to a sperm bank is that I feel as though I have a particular relationship to and responsibility for my offspring. And therefore, I would be prepared, I guess, to donate sperm to a couple who I knew and thought very highly of, where I said, these are the kind of people I'd be happy bringing up my child. But I wouldn't want to have it So in that sense, there's a cost to me. But suppose it's happening after I'm dead, so it's not going to bother me in some sense or other. But my heirs say, look, you got $50,000 for this kid. You got it using the cellular property to which we are the heirs. Therefore, we should get a cut of that $50,000. People find the argument convincing or not?
I think maybe for in the case of the descending from the cell lines, that might be more convincing for the heirs to have some kind of property.
Yeah, that seems like the ultimate descending from the cell.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's why I was taking it as sort of the extreme version of that. I'm trying to take sort of extremes in both sides. Yeah?
Yeah, again, it seems to happen with the question of, is it right to have an essentially an estranged relative all the time? That question seems to alter my intuition so much that I just have trouble.
That's interesting. What's your intuition in the perfectly ordinary old technology case? Woman has an affair with a man. She gets pregnant. They break up before he knows she's pregnant. Does she have a moral? She decides to bring it to bear the child and to bring it up. Say, does she have a moral obligation to tell him?
Yeah, it feels intuitively yes.
See, that in a sense blends these, because you could argue that since he knows that sex can result in reproduction, he implicitly gave his consent. But of course, he might reply, "Oh no, the consent I was giving was that if you do get pregnant, we'll then discuss it and jointly decide what to do." So maybe he wasn't giving his consent. Now, it's interesting to think of the degree to which some of these are really old issues and not new issues, because I'm sure that story must have happened at some point in the past. I can certainly imagine someone feeling it was.
Do you think there's any difference with people who are carrying like a rare mutation versus something else that's more commonly found in the population? Would they have more of a claim to some kind of exclusive right because of the uniqueness of that characteristic?
Well, the case where that is one case which let me give it a sort of a case which slightly blends my two. Let me suppose that I examine the DNA of the AIDS immune people. And I discover that a particular, very particular gene does it. And I don't have their permission to use it for some reason. That is, they've let me study it, but they've said, but by the way, if you produce any products that use descendants of my cell, you need my permission. And I said, well, that's very nice, but you may charge a high price for permission. Now I'm going to go out to the population in general, and it just so happens that I've got a bank from, thanks to 23andMe, of a million of cells for a million people. 23andMe, for an appropriate price, agrees to go through those and put me in contact with everybody who has your rare variant thing. And I just then send out letters to 73 people saying, I have discovered that you have a genetic variant that I'm very interested in. At what price are you willing to let me make descendant cells? So I have ended up with exactly the same result as if I had taken your cell, somehow cut out that gene variant, and then used it. But I've never actually gotten it from your cell. I've gotten it from somebody else with their permission. Is that a different case? I don't know. It just seems to me that a lot of this stuff gives the kind of issues that one hasn't thought about and that are intriguing to think about, that in terms of sort of law and what law ought to be and morality and everything else. Anyway, going back to this, so does how many people think that in the learn from cell case the right rule is no right at all? How many are pretty sure that isn't the right rule? Right. People are allowed not to be sure, obviously, but we usually are after all. How about the descend from cell? Is there anybody who thinks that the no right answer is the right answer in the descend from cell? Right? How about the property right rule? Anybody who thinks that in the learn from cell case, the right rule is a property rule. Namely, if I give you permission to examine my cells, you're entitled to then use that information any way you like. I no longer have a right to it.
But if you examine my cells without my permission, that's my doorknob again, then you've somehow violated my rights and I can enjoin you from using that information or sue you for a fair payment for it or something like that. How many people think that in the learn from cell, the property right is the right? Maybe. All right. Interesting possibility. How many people think that in the descend from cell, the property right is the right? That's my view at the moment, but I'm willing to change it. And then finally, the non-waivable rule. All right, the non-waivable rule says, if you get information from my cells, whether or not I agree to let you have that information, I have some kind of a property right. We go into details exactly what it is, but some kind of a property right, or some kind of a right, to the returns from that. Maybe I've got the right to what the court decides is a fair royalty for the information. Something like that. How many people think the non-waivable right makes sense for learning? How about for descending from? How about for saying, I don't get, let me take the case where it sounds in a sense most plausible as a non-waivable. I agree that you can use my cells whatever you like. What you decide to use them is not just to clone me once, but to clone me 10,000 times. And discovering you're doing that, I say, oops, sorry, that wasn't what I intended. I have, for whatever reason, some strong objection to cloning 10,000 times. And imagine that whatever you're doing with your cloning is not illegal on any other basis. You know, maybe you want to make slaves or something, but suppose you don't, or suppose slavery is legal in the society, or whatever assumptions you want to make, do I have some kind of a right that sort of is stuck into my cells, and therefore whatever I have agreed to, I get a claim with regard to it. How many people think that I do? Try to give the most sympathetic version. Alright, nobody. You do, maybe. Alright, you can talk some more about it. This is what I wanted to say, because it struck me listening earlier to you talk that this was an interesting way of thinking about it. Maybe you go further, maybe I'm not covering enough. Maybe we ought to have, for example, one could have a liability right rather than a property right. One could say, you can't sign the agreement, but you can only sue if you suffer damage as a result of their use of it. You can probably imagine others. I mean, they're interesting. And people, I've given a sort of a threefold division. Would somebody offer another plausible rule that we might apply to either of my categories? Yeah?
I kind of like the rule that the learn from the cell that if they're getting it from a source that's kind of unauthorized, so maybe you could give them your cells, then they can learn whatever they want from it. But if they're going out stealing cells, then maybe there's a criminal protection for your cells.
Yes. And yet there's no criminal protection, as far as I know, for my waste paper. As far as I know, if I throw away a piece of waste paper in the trash and you say, oh, I need something to scribble a note on, and you pull it out, I don't think you've stolen anything from me. I've given up.
No, but this seems more personal than a piece of waste
paper. It does. And of course, it also seems to me, if you actually were trying to, if you were a judge rather than a theorist, you'd also want to think about things some of which his story suggests, namely, is it somehow wrongful if I got your permission to yourselves while deliberately misleading you as to what I was going to do with them? What if I know that there's reason to think they've got really important value? I never actually say they don't because the question doesn't come up, but I imply that I just want yourselves as part of my routine studies. You can imagine a range of other cases of that sort where you might say, what's wrong? Other ideas on this before we go on to games? Is that next subject? Yes.
I also sort of have the inclination that a scientist might think this distinction between learning from a cell and descending from a cell doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them. That in the process of learning from a cell, there's going to be destruction. You're going to be rebuilding versions of the cell that make the exact copies of the cell. There's going to be a whole lot more stuff going on there, technically, than we maybe catch here within this sort of sharp distinction.
That might be. Let me give you one more hypothetical, which sort of, again, breaks down what the boundaries I like to draw to make it easier.
Okay.
And that is that I take your cell, I do a complete genotyping, which we'll assume can be done by the time this story is being told. Destroy your cell in the process. However, by now we've got genetic engineering, so I rebuild it again. All right, this is a nanotech future. I've now got a description of where every atom in your DNA went. So once I got that description, pretty straightforward. tell my general purpose assembler, put the atoms together in this fashion, zip, we've got an exact copy of your cell, which was made, well, in one sense, of course, because when we have a line of cells descending from yours, they're only copies of yours. So maybe the answer is the copyright answer, which says that what the real property to is not the physical object, but the information embedded in it, that learning for that information is all right, as in my Tolkien example, but actually copying that information. All right, let me leave it and let our next, because we've got, I think, a couple more interesting papers, which at least one of which we'll hopefully get into today.
So whoever it is who's got the first, are you the first of the gaming papers? There are two gaming papers, and I put them in order and so forth. I hope you people are finding this fun, because I am.
Hopefully this will bring a little fun.
Yep.
A little quick.
Right, you can get out of this entirely. Ah, okay. Very good.
That's true for you.
Yeah.
You may want to think, by the way, of whether you're violating copyright law at this very instant.
Maybe the person who posted it.
Yeah, well, you're performing it.
Okay. As you can see, that was the commercial for the upcoming 2K14 basketball game. And it's really interesting because as technology starts to progress, the identities of these individuals are becoming ever more obvious, ever more clear, ever more realistic. But though that shouldn't matter in a right of publicity claim, and that's what my issue is dealing with, is the right of publicity in video games. So, as you can see there, you could tell from like the facial expressions of LeBron James or the unibrow of Anthony Davis that you know exactly who these people are. And a slight digression, I believe Anthony Davis is seeking a trademark for his unibrow, or as a monobrow. So the right of publicity in video games has become contemporarily, a really big issue with the EA's NCAA franchise games. I haven't played them personally, but I do know them to be basically based upon EA's other sports games, including Madden, NBA Live, and FIFA. So there are these class actions that are being brought in federal circuit, or that have been come up to the federal circuit courts on coast to coast. And they involved the right of publicity claims asserted by former student athletes. These student athletes, well, current student athletes, like, you know, the ones who are well known right now, Johnny Football, for instance, who also has trademarked that name, they're not privy to this lawsuit because of the NCAA bylaws that prohibit them from receiving compensation from third parties. But these claims involve former students who, although entering contracts while they were college athletes, they effectively signed into perpetuity the rights of publicity. They've also brought some other antitrust claims, but the focus for my paper was on their right of publicity claims. So, what is the right of publicity? It sort of escapes a precise definition just because it's predominantly state law. That is, there is a federal law. The closest thing would be the Lanham Act, which prohibits the use of someone's name or license in connection with a commercial product. But nonetheless, the restatement has provided a somewhat broad definition of what the right of publicity is, that is, being the commercial value of a person's identity, which includes the name, license, and other indicia of identity, for purposes of trade. And in that, there's a five-part claim, which is generally, or five elements to that for a plaintiff's claim, which requires the defendant to have used the plaintiff's identity. That identity has commercial value. The defendant appropriated that commercial value for the purposes of trade. There's a lack of consent, and then the resulting commercial injury. It's very similar to misappropriation concerning privacy laws, although you could probably consider the right of publicity as a property right for the rich and famous. Very likely that our identities and likeness wouldn't be used in connection with other products because we don't have that sort of recognition, that ease of recognition with the general public. And of course, this all presumes that or assumes that the use of that identity would help the underlying product. But it seems to be obvious that any business wouldn't use the identity but for the reason of promoting sales and profit. So California does have a civil code, or does have a right of publicity explicitly codified in the civil code. It was brought into these EA games were brought into federal court, and they have so far succeeded as a matter of law that there is very little defense when you consider the defendant's use of the defendant's right, First Amendment right. So. Now considering how you have the public interest in maintaining the property rights of individuals who have put in considerable investment into their likeness, there's underlying theories being one economic and the other labor theory to help justify the right of publicity. The economic theory being that, as the Supreme Court said, in the only case involving, or at least squarely addressing the right of publicity, that the protection for the right of publicity provides an economic incentive for the creator to produce a performance that would be interesting to the public. That is, it provides an incentive for the right holder to also prevent the over-commercial exploitation of their persona. So,
remember that everybody in this room is supposed to have read your paper already.
Yes, assuming so, I would like to, it's my position that if these companies were to use the identities of former student-athletes, they should at least be given permission. It seems...
Haven't they been? I thought you were saying something about a contract.
Well, they're held to contracts as student-athletes. Going over the bylaws of the NCAA, it's really long, and it doesn't make clear at all that these rights were assigned into perpetuity. Now these former students are the ones who are part of...
Because there's going to be two different things. One of them is that the bylaws say that while you're a student-athlete, you can't do X and Y.
Right.
But the student athletes have also signed a contract with somebody.
Student athletes have not. They're under contracts with the NCAA. But as soon as they have graduated school, those rights are still maintained by the NCAA. That is, the NCAA has the rights to assign the publicity rights of the students.
And does the contract say that we are assigning our publicity rights to the NCAA?
No, they do not. As they are student athletes. Now, the issue arises, of course, is when they graduate, they're no longer bound by that contract.
Excuse me, if they have signed a contract, you're still bound by a contract.
But it's temporary, and it relates to them being student.
But I thought the reason was they're being student athletes, but I thought you said that the contract, or at least they claimed the contract, assigned perpetual publicity rights. Does it or doesn't it?
It doesn't. It would effectively do that, and that's why plaintiffs were bringing a suit.
But what does the contract actually say?
It says that they cannot receive compensation from third parties while student athletes.
Is there anything at all in there about their right of publicity?
Explicitly, no. It just deals with their likeness and identity being unassignable to other people other than the NCAA.
Being unassignable to other people.
Yeah, they couldn't profit from their identity.
But the question of whether they couldn't profit while they're student athletes is separate from the question of whether they assigned the NCAA the right to sell certain uses of their identity. And you haven't told me yet. Have you read the contract?
From beginning to end, no. It's quite long. I have read the relevant purport.
And so it seems to me the part you've described so far is irrelevant. The part which says while you're a student athlete, you can't make any money out of this. Because I assume they are not claiming, I mean, student athletes often become professionals after all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they can't have signed a contract which say I can never in my life make money out of being a football player.
Of course.
So therefore, where in the contract do they have anything which provides a basis for saying that after they cease being student athletes, their right of publicity still belongs to the NCAA?
There isn't anything like that.
And then I don't understand what the basis is for one side of the suit.
I don't understand the question, I'm sorry.
If I have signed an agreement saying, this year I am not allowed to take payment for my writing,
mm-hmm.
and I signed the contract with you, it doesn't follow that next year you get to give away to somebody the right to publish my book.
That seems right.
So I don't understand. I don't know anything about the case, but my working assumption is that when there is a case that's happening, there is some argument for both sides. And so far, you don't seem to have given me, you've given me an argument for why, while they are student athletes, the NCAA may be able to do this. But I don't think you've told me what the NCAA's argument is for why, when they're not student athletes.
Well, as the cases were before they were eventually settled, the lawsuits concerning the conflicting interests of right of publicity and the game developer's First Amendment right of expression, was the conflict was between the creator of the game and the actual student athlete. Whether there's a contracting issue.
But I thought you weren't you claiming that the NCAA said that it was the one that could license the permission?
They were. Whether it was right of them or not was an issue for the court.
But as you've told the story, they only have a basis for licensing the permission while the student is a student. That seems to be the story you're telling.
Yes.
Are they claiming to be able to license permission after he's no longer a student?
They are, but
on what basis?
On the basis of some part of the contract. But
what part of the contract?
I guess an unwinnable part of it because they.
Yeah.
I think part of it is that the NCAA made the agreement with EA, and this particular litigation was between EA and the former student athlete. It wasn't between NCAA and as a student.
But EA can't say we're allowed to do it because we've got permission to do it unless they were given permission by somebody who had a right to give permission.
NCAA, a lot of the trademark issue and the personal rights publicity stuff was actually tied all together in one big contract between NCAA and EA.
But what about the, but just, do you know
that's
more about it?
So from what, and I'm not an expert on this particular subject either, but from what I remember, what happened was publishers went to the NCAA and said, hey, we're making this video game, we want to buy the rights to all your players.
Right.
And the NCAA said, okay. And they had, at that point, all these players who were out of contract with the NCAA, there was no basis for the NCAA to provide this license to the developers, and all this other stuff was tied up in it because they also want to use the NBA logo.
So is EA claiming that their agreement with the NCAA gives them rights to represent these on what basis if they are no longer students? That's what I'm not understanding about this whole story. I can understand how EA might say we don't need permission because this is a creative First Amendment, etc. That's a possible argument.
EA thought they had permission. They thought they got.
They could easily have had permission while they were still student athletes, but I'm trying to figure out how they could think they had permission afterwards. Yeah.
My memory is that the game was created while everyone who was in the game was still a student.
Right.
So when it was physically created, the problem is that the game exists and is then sold in years after the students graduated and are no longer covered by that agreement. So I think that's where.
So that's where the argument is.
Aha!
Uh-huh. All right, that gets a little bit clearer.
Thank you. So yes, it does get really confusing quickly, but I wanted to sort of focus on the justification.
Yes. Go on.
Justification for the right of publicity, of course, there being an economic argument, but it was just recently said about the incentives, but also the labor theory, which, of course, is rooted in Lockean philosophy. But it's not a winnable argument, because you also have competing interests of the First Amendment. It says in my paper, too, that there are that every person is entitled to the fruits of their labor, but to the extent there are compelling countervailing public policy considerations. So the freedom of expression was a defense that was raised by EA Games in these lawsuits. Unfortunately, they were weren't winning with that argument, they eventually had to settle, which I haven't explicitly put in my figure up in the conclusion, but EA has recently decided to temporarily suspend their NCAA franchise. That has been going on for 10 some odd years. But they have decided to settle for tens of millions of dollars with these former student athletes and completely ended their NCAA franchise. So when the courts are looking at this First Amendment defense to these public policy or the right of publicity claims, they often adopt a transformative test. The transformative test looks to whether the work in question adds significant creative elements so as to be transformed into something more than the mere likeness of the plaintiff. That is, whether the product containing the celebrity's likeness is so transformed that it becomes primarily the defendant's own expression. You can see in the news segments that they're often using representations of ongoing celebrities, but you know, TMZ is founded on that idea of using the likeness of celebrities to draw consumer attention. But the question becomes whether that use is transformed because of a significant creative contribution by the artist. And of course, without that added feature, the interest in protecting the fruits of the plaintiff's labor is substantially outweighed by the expressive interests of the defendant artist. So there are a host of cases that I described in my paper that have used the transformative test, sometimes to the success of the plaintiff, other times, the defendant, and then other times not so much. But the thing about EA Games that was very interesting was that it's really difficult to assert freedom of expression because there's nothing really inherently expressive about a game that is built around the very likeness of the individuals engaging in what is exactly that they do that have given them their sort of their fame. There were cases involving a band hero where no doubt was performing songs other than ones that they would perform, but because they were engaging in the same activity that they achieved their renown, achieved their celebrity status, that was enough to allow the plaintiffs to succeed on the right publicity claim because they weren't giving their consent to that use. So I thought the issue, I thought the issue kind of may have became moot a few weeks ago when EA decided to halt that franchise and to settle the claims. But I still think it's a very important issue just because of the count.
So what should the rule be?
The rule should be that if you are, depending on, I do appreciate the transformative test because you do have two very important interests, one being the public, the property rights of the individual, and the other being the expressive works. The First Amendment, of course, Brown v. Entertainment Merchants that I described was the first Supreme Court case that held video games do have First Amendment protection, just because they're much like books and movies and other forms of media before them, they have an expressive.
So what should the rule be? Imagine we're doing it brand new, leave the NCAA out of it entirely because that seems like really a red herring to the issue you're really looking at. Mm-hmm. There is a game being played by 20 different teams, each with 20 people on them. I want to make a video game out of it. Should I be allowed without their consent to do it? Should I require unanimous consent from all 400 players before I can make the game at all? How do you think it ought to be handled?
I think depending on how altered your game is as it is to reality.
Take it just like the one you showed us at the beginning.
Well, that, for example, there are licensing deals that are happening between not only the players and player associations, but the teams, every...
Leave out all the irrelevant complications, because just take the simple case, I want to make a game, I've got whatever other rights I need, and my game is going to portray very close copies of 400 different players. What rights ought I to need in order to do that? What should the legal rule be and why?
The legal rule should be that you are to... You should be required to have their consent.
And if that's the rule, will the game ever get made?
It can be. When you consider blockbuster ones like Madden or FIFA that sell millions of dollars and create that add to the revenues of billion-dollar game.
I don't know this world at all. What are Madden and FIFA?
Okay, Madden and FIFA are equivalents, but of course in football and soccer, to the commercial.
And does each of them need for it to work to be able to accurately represent essentially all of the players in the game?
The licensing issues, unless it's a really well-known celebrity who kind of stands out as a free agent, the licensings are all often negotiated between player associations, team ownerships.
As part of what I'm trying to get at mm-hmm. is the problem of what's sometimes called the anti-commons. The problem that if you have something which you can only do with unanimous assent of a large number of people, you never do it because each of them is a holdout. And then one solution might be that part of the standard contract when a team hires you is that you agree to delegate to them making such agreements and they make the agreement for the whole team. Part of it might be that part of the agreement when a team becomes part of a, whatever they call these super teams that people are playing within, the leagues I guess is the term, that the league says we get to represent all of you. I don't know how they're doing it, but it does seem to me it's an interesting question, and that if you're going to think of what the rule ought to be, you also have to think about how with that rule you're going to get desirable results. Y'all?
Oh, I'm kind of off topic.
Yes.
Did you find anything where they're distinguishing between commercial and non-commercial uses of the right of publicity? I know that's basically the line in trademarks when you're talking about First Amendment defense, is if it's non-commercial speech, it's pretty much a free-for-all. And I know that at least in the trademark area, video games have been considered non-commercial speech. Did you find anything where they were talking about the line between commercial and non-commercial expressive works? Or do they not
need to
care about that?
There is a stronger interest for the right of publicity when the games are used in a commercial context because there is the value that's associated with the person's identity being used, being exploited by the game developers for their benefit. The transformative test isn't the only test that's available. Of course, there's the Rogers test, which deals with sort of the public confusion, whether the identity is being used for the product and whether there's a relatedness between it. But the interest in protecting the property rights of the individual are much heavier and stronger in a commercial context, as opposed to just being sort of done for a non-commercial reason, or at least not non-monetary reasons.
What would be an example of a non-commercial equivalent of what you're looking at?
That, yeah, I don't know, open floor. I mean, a lot of times people spend considerable investment money in making a game just for the reason of being able to sell it and make a profit on it.
And that's commercial, isn't it?
That's commercial. So it's hard to understand who, I mean, unless you consider maybe, some sort of open source game or...
What if it's political? What if I want to make an ad either for or against Obamacare?
Yeah,
and for this ad, I want to show how a particular... real person who people feel strongly about might be hurt by Obamacare or help make it hurt for a moment. So I use computerized methods to show a drama in which this person loses his or her vital health insurance because of Obamacare. And I don't engage in fraud. I have a statement at the beginning and end saying this is a work of fiction, but I also don't have permission to the person. Is that a non-commercial use?
It may be commercial, you may be selling it, making money off of it, but the rule becomes, or that interest becomes a little less significant when you're dealing with public officials because you deal with political speech.
Well, but in the imagined case, the people whose personality I'm using aren't public officials. The person I'm using, who's the famous scientist who's a lifetime cripple?
Stephen Hawking.
So I'm going to use Stephen Hawking. I'm going to imagine some case in which terrible things happen to Stephen Hawking because of Obamacare, or what happened without Obamacare. It doesn't matter which side is being done. And so I say at the beginning of my ad, just imagine if Stephen Hawking lived in America, how he would now be dead because Obamacare would say that, or how he would be dead if we didn't have, or how he would be dead if they didn't have the British health system, which is not Obamacare, but which is a different kind of government. So suppose I'm doing something like that, and I'm doing it in order to persuade people to vote for or against a candidate, and I'm paying for it myself. I'm a partisan. I'm not hiring anybody else to do it.
I think you might have answered your question right there, because you did it for the purpose of of a political objective.
Yes.
That is getting some sort of swaying the vote
right.
towards your favor.
So that's not commercial.
I wouldn't consider that commercial just because it's you're not using that person's identity for the purpose of exploiting the value of their identity. I think it's...
I am exploiting the value of their identity to try to change the result of an election, aren't I?
But not...
Do I have to be exploiting it for money?
Well, if I were to make a rule, probably. It would seem to be a more clear line if you were to do it.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm obviously obsessed with fairness in this issue, but...
No, I was struck by the idea that a video game wasn't a commercial activity, which I think is what you said the court said, which sounds weird to me.
Yeah, well, what's weird to me is that I feel like the line should be less what your intentions are in creating a speech. I mean, maybe it should come into account, but also... how someone perceives the speech. I mean, if that political ad, I wouldn't necessarily think that Stephen Hawking was endorsing that ad or had, it's not the kind of thing I would expect that you'd go out to get his permission to use. Whereas video games, where we're used to in like Madden or FIFA, they have to get permission of the individual player depicted. Well, then when you have one taking place in a collegiate atmosphere, the public expects that they did get permission. So if a player
So where you want to, that's interesting, because let's get these two different alternatives. Where you want to draw the line is at misleading the consumer.
Yeah.
So your view would be that as long as EA somehow makes it perfectly clear that they don't have permission from the players, that then they can proceed without any permission from the players. Is that what your argument says? So the trademark line.
That is what the argument said. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with it fully, but
right.
I mean that.
Whereas your view is that even they make it perfectly clear, they nonetheless aren't allowed to portray these players without their permission.
Yes, I think it goes to whether the expressive worker, whether it be expressive or not, whether the work derives its value mainly from the defendant's own contribution or the plaintiff's identity. Which, when you put the example out of Stephen Hawking, I don't think people were buying that to reenact the life of Stephen Hawking. They were buying it, if they would, I don't know who would, but if they did, it was to understand the political point that was being discussed in it. When someone buys an EA NCAA game, isn't it because they want to give money to EA, or it isn't because they want to, because they like the idea of NCAA sports, but because they want to be able to play their team, their college team.
Let me take the argument one further. Suppose we say what they want is not to play player so-and-so. Maybe they do. They want to play their team. So I say, well, actually, we don't need permission from the players. We just need permission from the team. Suppose the team has not gotten the players to sign away their rights of publicity. But the team argues, what we are giving you is the right to represent our team, the right to play a game. Well, it happens that in order to do a good job of showing our team, you've got to show the players. So therefore, the owner of the team is claiming that it's that he has the right of publicity rather than the players do. Is that a defensible position, anybody? I'm trying to see what interesting ways one can run this set of issues that aren't being considered.
To make the economic argument starts to fall apart when you at least the statement was considering when the profession or the line of work or the activity by which the person has become famous for has their own sort of rewards in themselves. If you want to make an economic argument as to the individual being able to have the steadfast rule or hard line right to their publicity, it becomes more difficult when those licensing deals are so incidental.
What if they weren't incidental? Suppose we say, look, at the moment, at the moment, probably most people watch football games on television rather than in a stadium, don't they? Is that a correct statement? So you could take it one step further. Suppose we've got a point at which the way the sport goes is they make your reputation by playing some real games, but you make your income. By then, and you can imagine much more sophisticated version. I mean, I don't know these games, but imagine a version in which I'm not just having a character who looks like you, I'm having a character who plays like you. That you have, I know that there occasionally have been cases in various sports where somebody was famous for doing something in a really weird way. I don't remember what they are, baseball batters and things. And, suppose there were a batter who held his bat by the wrong end and worked. But you can imagine there must be an awful lot, I suspect, not being an athlete, of stuff in which you could say, well, this player developed this particular style of play, and we're going to copy that style of play when we reproduce him. And that, yep.
So yeah, I mean, that kind of goes back to the Vanna White case. I don't know if you're familiar with it. There was a commercial where they had essentially a robot, Vanna White,
yep.
And she sued saying that you're using my personal identity. And they said, no, they're just using what you do. They aren't using you. So I think it would be very similar, where I think it would be permissible in the context of someone who has a unique style. It's not, I mean, it is associated with them uniquely, but I think that it's not part of who they are as a person.
I thought she lost it. I haven't read it in like 2 years.
Yeah, she did.
But of course, no, everyone likes
the Kaczynski. It's Kaczynski, the only Reagan appointee judge who was an ex-member of a communist organization. Has he introduced himself once for a talk?
Yeah, that line from it, I think, it's sort of bad medicine to reduce every conceivable item of value to property.
Uh-huh.
So what if they're not playing basketball? So that's like, I can imagine a really successful game, call it like backyard football NBA, right?
Yeah.
LeBron James and everyone like
yeah.
that. And they would totally get behind that kind of thing. Like, they would love that. And if you produce that,
I think EA would have a better chance if they made that game. Because they're not engaging in the activity by which they've renowned.
Even if it's clear.
Even if
the whole reason, like, you're not buying the game to play backyard football. You're buying the game because you get to play LeBron James playing backyard football.
Yeah. That's actually a really interesting hypothetical. There was a case that I discussed slightly in my paper about the comic book, the winner, the Supreme Court case. Dealing with the two singers, what were their names? These two singers, they were battling the fictional character Jonah Hex. They were sort of a half human, half worm hybrid. But if they were engaged in something completely unrelated to what they were known for, that is making music, they were sort of battling. You know, it's a really weird kind of comic book. Where the consumers, the people who know those two singers, knew that's what these characters were representing, were these two singers. But there was sufficient enough changes to the characters and the ongoing context of the game that it would receive First Amendment protection. Perhaps, too, if you start using, you know, athletes from one...
I think we're out of time now, and we get a couple more game papers, I think, in another 2 days. It's also so I think that's probably enough for you. I don't think we have to come back.